I would like today to complete, complete is a word I suppose I should never use, to continue for a while the discussion of the contrast between the magical and the scientific kinds of orientation as representing the two extremes of a continuum along which we may vary and along which persons and cultures may be said to have average modes or modal tendencies. We had gotten down to number seven. I'll be brief about this because I want to get on to talking about the process of abstracting. But there are some things here that are interesting enough, I think, to take our time for a little while. The point of the ventriloquizing, I don't know whether there is such a word, but I think we need it. The word is supposed to represent the tendency to attribute what you say to some greater authority, as in the case of the person who says, the law says, the judge who says, the law says. Well, it's Elmer who's talking, and he happens to have on robes. Now, I don't suppose we could conduct our courts in any other way, but at least it's possible to recognize what is going on. And I think we need a name for it, and I think this is a rather good name, ventriloquizing. It is as though, in the case of the ventriloquist, it were the dummy who was doing the talking, but he would be saying that he isn't really talking. He's talking with the voice of the ventriloquist. And of course, that's what he's doing. But we don't usually think that it is the dummy who's doing the talking. I hope I have indicated what I mean by the word and have not confused you. Now, persons who behave scientifically tend to take responsibility for their own statements. They don't attribute them to someone else or to something else. Even when they quote another speaker, they take responsibility for selecting what they quote. They might have quoted someone else. And so they acknowledge their own evaluations. Finally, and one of the very most significant differences, I think, between these two kinds of orientation, in a magical orientation, one places almost no value upon prediction. In fact, among magicians, among people who believe in magic, the person who makes successful predictions is suspect. And he may be eventually classified as a witch and burned. The ability to make predictions in magical cultures is taken to be somehow uncanny. In scientific orientation, of course, prediction is the heart of the matter. That's what it's all about. You make predictions in order to control forthcoming events. You make predictions about what will happen if you use a vaccine in order to control, and you test the predictions. And if they are good, it provides a means for controlling disease, for example. Prediction is the very heart of science as behavior, as an orientation. And this is not something you have to reserve for a laboratory with $10 million worth of very highly precise apparatus. This is an attitude that you can exercise all day long, no matter where you are. You can value prediction and foresight. You can look ahead to greater or lesser degrees, with greater or lesser sophistication about what you're doing when you do it. In a magical orientation or culture, since there is practically no value placed on prediction, except in a magical sense, except as one accepts the magician as having the power to foretell, a kind of special perception. Because of this attitude, the tendency is to attribute whatever happens to fate or luck. Whatever will be, is the prevailing attitude. And again, our popular songs, I think, are very revealing of the cultural orientation of the folk. Whatever will be, is the name of one of our more popular songs, usually sung in French, I believe. Very common attitude, as though there's nothing to predict, there's no point in predicting, it's almost sacrilegious to predict. Things will work out the way they're supposed to work out. Who are you to be trying to make predictions? You know, this sometimes takes rather odd turns of amusing sort. I went to a horse race one time, the only horse race I ever went to in my life, at Hollywood Park in Los Angeles. One of the fellow faculty members there, when I taught there one summer, at USC, badgered me until finally one day I went with him. And he proceeded to show me how to use a racing form. I had never seen one before. And he began to help me make my bets. I said, no, I'm going to make my bets. And so he lost, I don't know, $15 that afternoon, and I ended up making $37.50. you know what? After that, for several days, the news of this got around. People would ask me, how do you do it? What's your secret? The idea is, you see, in a magical culture, that if you can make predictions, if you can win, on the horses, you must have some kind of a special power. It's the magical attitude. There's nothing. I was very obviously scientific about it. Oh my! The point is that we're not so different from the way people were in the Stone Age. The tendency in a magical orientation, because of this basic attitude toward prediction, is not to change one's procedures, one's beliefs, because they have nothing to do with what happens. That's out of your hands. Yeah, this is. Don't fool with that. Whereas in a scientific orientation, we tend to use prediction as the test of our theories, our assumptions. We base our predictions on our theories. And how good the predictions are constitutes the test of the theories. And so we are constantly changing our theories in a scientific orientation. This means that considering science as behavior, daily behavior, to the degree that you behave scientifically, you tend to change your mind. You tend to pay attention to what you said would happen. And if it doesn't happen, you change your mind with regard to the beliefs and assumptions relevant to that prediction. But to the degree that you are magically oriented, this would never occur to you. And so you tend to change more with a scientific mode of orientation. Let me just take 1 minute to call your attention, before I leave this, to some recent developments that I think are very exciting and very promising. One of the places where our magical modes of operation are, I think, the most tragic, are in international relations, in the assumptions, the beliefs, the attitudes we operate with that have to do with peace and war. I think anyone who is at all sensitive and informed must be impressed with the degree to which our State Department or anything comparable to this in other nations, but especially in the democracies. I say this because in a dictatorship it is possible to change things more easily. You don't have to put it to a vote, or even when you don't have to do that, in a democracy like ours, you have to be sensitive to public opinion about what you're doing. That is, you have to if you're going to stay in office. Now, and it's quite important to do that if you're going to do anything. We have ways of doing things in international relations. They get pretty set, pretty fixed. They become almost ritualistic. And it's very difficult to do much about it. In the last couple of years, 3 years, 5 years, it's hard to know when these things begin. They probably started at a cocktail party 10 years ago. But Dr. Osgood of the University of Illinois, who lectured here last year, maybe some of you heard him, on some work he's been doing in the general area of research on conflict. And he's especially interested in possible techniques for reducing conflicts. And the gist of his idea is the reciprocal reduction of tension-producing behavior. And he would advocate, for example, that in a case like the Berlin Wall, let's pull back 100 yards and see what happens. Now, maybe they'll pull back 100 yards or 50. You get the idea. Let's reduce the number of men we have there by 1,000 and see what happens. Now, they may increase and take advantage of it, but they may reduce 1,000. Let's see what will happen. Let's at least be experimental, you see, and not magical about it. Let's don't operate as though we knew for absolutely sure what would happen. Let's experiment. Where we can, in a place like the offshore islands, off Red China, Kimoi, Matsu, let's reduce the forces, let's stop the firing, if there is any, let's change the routes of the reconnaissance planes, let's do things we can that will reduce the alertness, reduce the tension, and see what happens. Now, if they don't reduce, all right, we'll build up again. If they do, fine, let's do it some more. And this is the sort of thing that you can do in a husband-wife situation where tensions build up. It's a good way to handle a conflict situation between two persons. One, take the initiative in doing something that will reduce the tension, and see if the other one might reciprocate. And usually this is what happens, if it's possible, if it's not too dangerous to do so. Well, Osgood's work, I think, will bear watching. It is attracting some attention. He's doing some research for the government. One of my friends is head of one of the government agencies that is concerned with disarmament. I mean, he's concerned with armament, but after all, if we're going to go to disarmament conferences and talk to any kind of point, we've got to have things we can concede. Otherwise, there is nothing to talk about. And so the research has to do with things like what could we reduce? How could you see, one of the big problems in this regard is that if you try to reduce our armaments, this means that filters down operationally to some town where there's a factory making a part for a missile. And you're going to cancel a contract or not renew it. And this means that factory is going to lose business. And this means that people are going to be put out of work. And immediately you will get a reaction from that community. And they will all write their congressman. And this is what you deal with in a democracy. People in that town will go to their churches on Sunday morning and all be for peace. But they don't want anybody thrown out of work in their town. And they're making missiles. So, we need to have research done on this problem. What can you do with people thrown out of work because of disarmament? What would you do? What would you have them do in our kind of an economy? Or are you prepared to change the economy? What are you prepared to do? You talk for peace. What are you prepared to do to get it? This is what the research is about. Nosgood's been doing some of this. Another kind of research and thinking that's been going on that I think is very promising has to do with game theory. Been a great deal written since Neumann, the mathematician, first wrote about game theory some 15 years ago. One of the best books on it that you'll find is on the reading list by Rappaport. It's called Fights, Games, and Debates. Fights, Games, and Debates. I think I put it on the list. I did. It's a study and analysis of these kinds of conflicts in terms of basic game theory. And here's the latest one by one of the very most significant men of our time, a man named Kenneth Boulding. He's an economist at the University of Michigan. Incidentally, he's a fellow stutterer. Poet, thoroughly educated human being, and one of these rare persons who not only knows a great deal, but can write well. He has a feeling for language and for communication. And this book, which just came out, is called Conflict and Defense, Kenneth Boulding. You know, I think the most important thing that you can find around a university are the teachers worth knowing. And I think about the most important thing that you can find in the world are the authors worth knowing, the persons worth knowing. If I do nothing but introduce you to Kenneth Boulding, I will done you a favor. Course will have been worth it, but you'll have to follow up and get to know him. He's written another book, which is on the list, the reading list, The Image. Well, I wanted to tell you about these developments. I think they carry some genuine promise of improvement in a situation that is otherwise not just dismal, but downright horrible to contemplate in some, from some points of view that are not altogether fanciful. I'd like to start talking about the process of abstracting. This is in large part what everything I have said up to now has been pointed toward. The problems we've been considering, the approaches to them we've been talking about, can be clarified and pointed up and developed in terms of the process of abstracting, a bodily process carried on in the nervous system. And we've mentioned time binding. Abstracting is a mechanism which makes time binding possible. General semantics is the study of time binding. If you don't want to call it a science, call it a disciplined, responsible attempt to study. Now, I could talk a great deal about this, but I would rather try to be lean in my remarks. I want to review briefly something that I said the other day in another connection about abstracting. I drew a diagram on the board, if you remember. I want to draw it again, but I want to say today some other things about it. You remember I drew it like this, the verbal left, or the naked eye level. The lens level of the, let's call it the seeable, and I mean by that observable, and the realm beyond the microscope, the beable, what we imagine must be to account for what we see. And we have verbal levels. These are nonverbal levels of abstracting. I'm talking about a process which is going on inside your nervous system all the time. And you call it by such, you refer to it by such words as observing, perceiving, feeling, thinking, judging, speaking, writing, listening, etc. There are as many levels of language, theoretically, as you care to make for your purposes. We talked the other day about three levels: description, classification, explanation. Remember? Description, classification, and explanation. And at the top, you always have a very important word, etc., because you can always abstract your highest order abstract, you can always evaluate your last evaluation. So you abstract this, presumably, from this, or this from this, and this, and this, and this from this. And when you get to the levels of explanation about what you have reported, described, and classified, what you have observed, now you're explaining it, you're talking about what might be to account for what you have seen. All right. Just enough to remind you. Now, I want to say some things at some length. I want to stress one point to rest this hour. We talk about the nonverbal levels and the verbal levels. And we talk in other languages that we use commonly, the folk language. We talk about mere words. We talk about deeds versus words. We tend to make a kind of separation of something, which in terms of this kind of context, you would call verbal levels and nonverbal levels of abstracting. Now, One of the very most important things to say about this process is that it is a unitary process. It cannot really be separated into two parts like that. It is a unified process, integrated as one process. Now, a great deal of the trouble we have, the problems we have, can be described, understood, as a kind of splitting of this unitary process, of acting as though you, you could split it. Let's relate to what I have just said to the very anatomy of the nervous system. You know enough about it, I'm sure, to follow what I have to say. You know about the sensory nerve endings in the eyes, ears, taste bud, touch buds, and so forth. You know about the nerve fibers which run into the nervous system and make connection through the synapses, as they are called, with the intermediate nerves, connecting nerves, which go to the parts of the brain inside the skull, and there are nerves which come out to the muscles and to the glands. Now, this is all one continuous circuit. This has some implications. The fact that this is all one continuous circuit. It means that what is going on inside your head should have some relationship to what goes on inside your muscles. This is a way of saying, in a rather physiological language, that what you think should have some relation to what you do. And you can bring this down to a little more descriptive level in talking about behavior by saying that what you say has a relationship to what you do in a well-integrated process of abstracting. If you know something, you act as though you knew it. On this basis, this very fundamental physiological, anatomical basis, there is something to say about certain kinds of philosophies of education. The kind in which, for example, there is disdain for anything practical. I by no means find it easy to have very much respect for this kind of a philosophy of education. And I know that makes me unpopular at the faculty club. And that, I can't help it. I think that if you know something, you should act as though you knew it. This means that to learn something may or may not be done with some specific practical end in view. But if you have learned something and you don't act as though you have learned it, this, within this kind of a context, is to be classified as pathological. This gives a basis for a diagnostic language. We're talking about the pathology of the process of abstracting. The basic pathology of it is to be seen in behavior which does not represent the integrity of the process. Now, let's have some examples. There's been some very interesting research done in the last few years on schizophrenia, which is our most common form of mental disease. You've probably all heard the startling statistic that one half of all the beds, all the hospital beds in the United States, are occupied by patients who have schizophrenia. That statistic puzzles you. The explanation that you may need is that this is a long-term illness. and people who have it stay in hospitals quite a while. And so, while the absolute number of persons who have pneumonia or who have appendicitis or something may be comparable, the hospital bed days, when you use that kind of measure, half of the hospital beds are occupied by patients with schizophrenia. Now, this is such a common kind of mental or emotional or evaluational or abstracting misfiring that it deserves far more attention than we've given it. Some recent research into the life histories of patients with schizophrenia has tended to isolate one very interesting looking factor, and that is the parent of the patient, a kind of home background in which the parents have tended not to mean what they have said. Hayakawa, last time I saw him, we were talking about this, and he said that he had been talking with a psychiatrist friend of his who told him about a mother he'd been seeing. And the mother was having, was presumably seeing the psychiatrist for her daughter, 12-year-old daughter. The psychiatrist was trying to find out about the situation and was asking about her relationship to the daughter. She said she loved her. She said, I tell the brat 1,000 times a day I love her. But she still hates me. This is the sort of thing that the research has revealed, this kind of saying things that are not meant. A kind of a divorcement of the verbal levels of abstracting from the nonverbal levels. No intended follow-through. I think we need to take a good look. Someone ought to get a grant and do some research on the use of the word dear. I think this would be very revealing. What do people seem to mean when they say dear? I think in many cases this represents a kind of divorcement of the verbal from the nonverbal levels. Come here, dear. I rode one day on a plane about a year ago from San Francisco to Denver. The plane was crowded. I got there late, and I ended up in the front seat, which has no seat ahead of it. And there was a mother by me, and it was a tourist plane, and there were three of these narrow seats. And the hostess got the mother her thing for the baby that fastens on the wall, and I finally got it fastened on the wall. And got the baby in it. But there was a little girl with the mother who was about 3 maybe. And it was a little difficult for this little girl to stay perfectly quiet. And the baby was in and out of this thing. It had to be held part of the time. The mother had her hands full. I was trying to write a lecture for the next town, and but I was being as helpful as I could. But and pretty soon, this poor mother, who probably had been up late, began to go all to pieces. And about every minute, from, I would say, about, Salt Lake City or thereabouts to Denver, the woman's voice came out, "Will you stop that? Stop that! Stop that!" This went on, just a continual bombardment of this. "Stop that! Stop that, I tell you, stop that! And I was interested in the... I was interested in the little girl. She evidently was fairly used to this because she didn't seem to pay much attention to it. It almost looked like the beginnings of the blandness that could develop into sort of a schizoid blandness. Words mean nothing after a while, you see. Well, this went on. Stop it! The plane started down into Denver, and we were soon to land. And it had come out in the conversation that they were going to be met by the grandparents. And so the little girl was all fussied up, and finally the mother turned to the little girl and she said, in about the same tone of voice as she had been using for to stop that, she said, now put on your happy face. On the boat the other day, I heard a mother talking to a little boy, and he was acting, little boys are, you know, and finally the mother said to the little boy in quite a tense tone, she said to the little boy, relax, you don't seem to know how to relax, relax before I get real angry with you. That's what I mean. Divorcement. A schizoid lack of relationship between what is said and what could possibly be meant. This takes some forms that have to do with the time sense. You've all seen the cartoon. Tomorrow we got to get organized. Not today. Reality exists now, you know. But our language, if you analyze it, and nobody has done this well, I hope some of you will get fired up and want to do some research on some of these basic things, like just counting the time words in language samples of people's actual speech. I think you would find far more words in the past and the future modes than in the present. And I think this is very significant. This is part of the mechanism for the divorcement between what we say and what we do. Because what you do now. And if you're going to relate your language to your actions, you must use a relatively high proportion of verbs in the present tense. I think. But we hear a lot of language, someday I'm gonna, or I wish I had. Another form that this takes that is very confusing to children and to others, to adults, is the discrepancy between law and custom. It must be very difficult for young people growing up to establish any very well-defined attitude about drinking in Iowa, for example, and in many other places. Well, I think in Iowa, it's probably worse here than it is in many places, because there's a law against it, but people do it in public. The mechanism is the key club, or the club And you can drink in a club if you belong. But this gets defined in practice, operationally, that it amounts to liquor by drink. And yet, young people are told in no uncertain terms that the law is that they're not supposed to do that. During Prohibition, of course, this was very phenomenal, this kind of confusion. We have it in many other areas of the law. We're a culture in transition, always, of course. But I think we're in a rather significant and definable, recognizable kind of transition from feudal society of class and caste, in which a person's name is more important than he is. And we are in transition to a society that is democratic, in which the individual is valued for himself. And in this kind of a transition, we make laws which are in the spirit of democracy. But we still have customs that are not. And so we have this great confusion about the racial issue. We say that legally, all the different kinds of people in our borders are equal before the law. It must be very confusing to many young people who find that, who read this, who hear it proclaimed from pulpit and rostrum, but they find that it ain't so for them. And this is a kind of discrepancy between what we say and what we do. And I think it's terribly necessary in this kind of a situation to understand something about language. Much of our language is not reporting language. It is not empirically based, so to speak. It is directive language. For example, a statement like, all men are created equal, can hardly be evaluated as a statement which reports observations that have been made. For one thing, nobody has ever observed all people. Well, it isn't that kind of a statement. It's a directive statement. It's a statement which serves the function of directing our thinking, our behavior, in a certain direction. It's sometimes called a self-confirming hypothesis. That is, call it a hypothesis. All men are created equal. Let's call that a hypothesis. See, the assumption is that if we say it often enough, in regard to enough situations, if enough of us do this, we will thereby build a culture in which it will be true. It is a self-confirming hypothesis. There are many self-confirming hypotheses. They are not all desirable as that one, perhaps. You've heard many people say, as a result of whatever experience they have had, don't expect anything good from anybody. Don't expect anybody to give you a break, etc. These are self-confirming hypotheses. They tend to be confirmed, because they tend to direct one's behavior into forms which don't bring out the best in folks. They do bring out bad behavior. The statement of the politician who says we will win by a landslide, this isn't the report of observations made. This isn't intended to be this. This is another one of these self-confirming hypotheses. If we say this often enough of us say it, we will win by landslide. It's a self-confirming hypothesis, or intended to be. This is its function. Well, I think if we understand this kind of language sufficiently well, we are able to endure many of the otherwise very baffling and demoralizing discrepancies between the law and custom, between what people say and what they do. We are, individually and as a culture, in transition. We say better than we act. We know better than we do. The hope is that if we talk well enough, if we talk a good enough line, we will in the end act a little more decently, because we will be speaking self-confirming hypotheses. I think I have time for one more point about the implication of this, of the fact that this is an integrated, unified process in the body, going on constantly. An implication of it is that if by nonverbal levels we mean roughly physical or activity, behavior, acting, the deeds, conduct, and if by the verbal levels we mean what we say, or we mean psychological, then it is not possible to divide problems into physical and psychological. You cannot split this process. Everything is both physical and psychological. Or at least what is psychological ought to correspond to what is physical, and vice versa, if you're going to use these words. The very use of the words tends to split the process into two divided parts. This is pathological, when we act as though they were split this way. I think that the time may come when we will have abandoned this terminology of organic versus functional, or physical versus psychological, and we won't have two kinds of hospitals. We will have people hospitals, and not hospitals for muscles and other hospitals for language. A person is a whole person. Your abstracting process is a unified process, and you cannot take part of it to one hospital and go to another with the rest of it. You can, but I don't think this is a good idea.